Hello and welcome to another episode of Fully Scored, episode 54 to be precise. What do we have coming up in this episode, I hear you rhetorically ask. Well, hold on to your horses, all is about to be revealed. First up, we have long-term principal cornet of the Melbourne staff band, Gary Todd, as our interviewee. Following our snapshot into Gary's life, music making and faith, we're going to be looking at one of James Curnow's finest works, The Great Salvation War, which is going to be expertly analysed by world-renowned Salvation Army musicologist Dr. Ronald Holtz. For our guest on Arid Island album today, we head to an island that certainly isn't arid, Bermuda, as we speak to Jerome Astwood. Once again, the episode finishes in the now traditional fashion, with a bash at band mastermind and slice of sparsely scored. Now, without further ado, let's head down under. Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's really great to speak to you. Many people will know that you are the principal cornet of the Melbourne staff band, and we'll be sure to discuss that shortly. But first, I'd like to know a little bit about how you came to play the cornet. What were some of your first experiences of music making?
Well, thank you very much, Matthew, for the invite onto this show. It's a real privilege, and I hope that my time sharing with you will be of interest to some people. So, probably my first memory of getting up and playing a solo might have been about six or seven. Dad had written me a very simple hymn tune type thing, eight bars. My sister was playing the piano. My older sister, Lindsay, plays the piano. She accompanied me, and I think we played in High Barnet Over 60s. As a little lad, just getting up and playing a little solo. That was the first thing Dad taught me. Many people will know the name Ray Todd. He's my father, a fine cornet player for many, many years at Chalk Farm. So I'll talk about him in a bit later.
And that leads really nicely on to my next question. Who were some of the key influences in your development as a musician at that young age?
Well, as I said, Dad was the major influence. He taught me to play. Like any kid, you never like to listen to your parents and when they come and tell you what to do. So we often had a bit of argument here and there, and I'd tell him to go away and all that sort of thing. But basically, I would listen to Dad practice, and I would just his influences and the music that he played and how he played it, and I just tried to copy it, and with a bit of technical work on top of that, and so Dad was the major influence really. As I was growing up, probably around 12 to 15 or something like that, Dad would often be asked to go and do special Saturday nights, solo playing. He said, can I bring my boy along? So I would go along with him. He'd play Clear Skies or any of the other big solos. I'd play Silver Threads or something like that. And then we'd play a duet together. So right from early on, he was giving me exposure to sort of standing up and playing solos and encouraging me all the way. Other people, my music teacher, the head of music, was a guy called Tom Jones. He was the bandmaster at the Luton Temple Corps at the time. So immediately I got to the school, we had a connection, and he was tremendously encouraging. And of course, Michael Clack, the bandmaster at Chalk Farm at the time, hugely encouraging to all the young guys in the band. So that was great. And then when coming here, joining the Melbourne staff band, the great Colin Woods, who was the bandmaster at the time, a tremendous band trainer, wonderful guy, and a good encourager.
Fantastic. It's really great to hear some of those memories there. And I'd love to unpack a little bit further some of your memories of growing up at Chalk Farm and your experience as a young musician in the UK at that time.
Well, yes. As I say, Chalk Farm was a tremendous band. When we were young, we would often be listening to the band. I had two very close friends, and they still are two of my closest friends. Many people will know Jonathan Evans, the euphonium player from the ISB, And he had an older brother called Mark. We grew up together. We're like the Three Musketeers. All Cornet players at the time. And we were given every opportunity to play. Even as Wipey Band lads, we were given opportunities to play trios with the senior band before we were old enough to be in the senior band. So that sort of thing was always encouraged. Once I joined the senior band, the band was always busy, and along with Mark and Jonathan, once Jonathan was the youngest, once he got into the senior band, along with another young guy who was on the back row with us, Carl, we had a fairly formidable back row, and we used to start Sunday afternoon programs with a Cornet Quartet Joyous Proclamation played by the back row. Just given plenty of opportunity. Carl went on to percussion. It went down to trios. Mark went on to soprano. It went down to Jonathan and I playing duets, Deliverance, Quicksilver, things like that. All being very young and just encouraged all the way. So it was a fantastic thing to be part of. As well as core banding, there was the North London Youth Band who I played in. In the 80s, Dad was the bandmaster of that band. And it was a tremendous band. We had some extremely good players who went on to become ISB members and things like that. So that was really good. Did the divisional music schools, band trainers like Jimmy Williams, George Whittingham, and also then the national music school, which was Cobham Hall back then. Got to go to a few of those and make wonderful friends. Who you're still in contact with until today. So, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I grew up with. A wonderful, wonderful army life and army play.
Listeners may be able to pick up that you don't really have much of a North London twang, but perhaps more of an Australian one. When did you decide to make the move to the other side of the world, quite literally? And what were the driving factors behind that decision?
Well, Chalk Farm, busy band, did a bit of touring. We got to go to Spain and Germany, and we had a tour of Australia in 1988, which was great. The middle weekend was spent in Melbourne, where I met a particularly beautiful girl in so many ways called Linda, and we got on very well over that weekend, so much so her sister and a friend even drove all the way up to Sydney for the next weekend as the band moved on, which is no mean feat. That's 10 hours driving for those of you who sort of don't know the Australian geography. So I had a very lovely weekend. And once the tour was over, I'd really enjoyed just visiting, seeing Australia and some of the things that were here. So I thought I might have a working holiday. So in 1989, I had a working holiday out here. I started in Melbourne because I'd got this contact with Linda. I never went anywhere else. Within 6 months, we'd got engaged. So, and then I loved the place so much, I was always happy to move here once we were married. So Linda came back to the UK with me in 89, spent some time getting to know my family and my friends, and then I emigrated in January in 91. So then, yes, got married in March in 91, have two fantastic sons. Both of those guys are married. Got two lovely daughter-in-laws. Bradley is married to Siobhan, and they have a son. Well, I have a grandson, Max, who's just a bit over two, and at the time of this recording of the podcast, I have a second grandson who's only 3 days old.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. So, yes, two lovely grandsons now. And my younger son, Matthew, is married to Brooke.
And what were some of the things that you noticed you had to adapt and adjust to living in a new culture, if any?
Well, there are so many similarities here more than anywhere else than in the US or even Canada. The Australian lifestyle is a little bit more laid back, which is fine for me. Any of you who know Australians, you'll know that they love their cricket and their rugby, both codes. So much so that the core I attend, Waverley Temple, at the time when I got here, they had three cricket teams. I love playing cricket, so I had to certainly improve my cricket skills. That was about it, really. Oh, and I had to learn to like Vegemite as well. That was kind of mandatory here. So.
Fantastic. So in 1991, shortly after you moved, you joined the Melbourne Staff Band. How did that appointment come about?
Well, having such a strong banding upbringing at such a good standard, it was important for me to try and maintain that here. So while I was here in 89 on my working holiday, I'd got to know a few guys in the staff band and the bandmaster, Colin. So I did say to him that when I returned, I would like to join the band. So within the first week of me being here, I'd done my staff band audition. The band were going on tour that year, in the middle of the year, and Colin didn't think it was probably right that I'd get in the band to go on tour straight away. And the band was full. I didn't need extra players. So I ended up joining in October of 91.
As I say, the rest is history.
We'll
talk a bit about that history now, if that's okay. So much like all the other staff bands around the globe, the Melbourne Staff Band has a multifaceted role in worship, from weekend ministry in and around Australia to international tours, CD recordings and many, many other events and occasions. Instead of just asking you the predictable, have you got any favourite moments, I'd be interested to know some of your highlights from these different aspects of the band's ministry. So first of all, have you got a favourite tour that you've been on with the band?
It's always great doing tours. There are some highs and lows on every tour that you go on. Being with the band when they come back to the UK is always a great occasion. The ISB 120 that gets mentioned every second podcast was a magnificent event to be part of. And the Boundless Congress as well. But I think one of the most special trips that the band has made is when we went to South Africa and Zambia. We were there for a territorial congress in Zambia, and there was, they claim, well over sort of 10,000 people there in a tent, kind of a tent meeting situation. Just incredible, absolutely incredible. The meetings would go for 3 to 4 hours. We were able to sort of be excused after 2.5 to 3. They didn't mind us going off. Sitting outside, just a little bit of shade cloth. They went for so long because they'd say, so-and-so Songs Brigade is going to come and sing to us. And 50 rows back, you'd see 7 rows of people get up. And then they'd sing themselves down the aisle, sing a song down the aisle, set up, sing their song, sing themselves back to their seats. Magnificent, absolutely fabulous experiences.
Yeah. And how about a most memorable recording session or album that you've recorded?
Well, we've gone through quite a few albums and recordings. There are a few scary moments when we had Professor David King as an executive producer. That puts you on the edge of your seat. But way back in 2001, the first tour that I had done back to the UK with the band, I was playing flugelhorn at the time. And we had a recording called Exaltation. Some really great music on that. The piece Exaltation, like a show opener, V-Doors to Carter. The beautiful melody from Isaiah 40, Comfort My People. The Power of Your Love, a tremendous transcription. And a solo I got to play called Up Yonder. So, I really enjoyed that recording. It was a long time ago now.
A fabulous recording, though, indeed. And another very difficult question, but what about the more regular weekend ministry of the band? Are there any particular memories that stick out to you from that aspect of the band's ministry?
Well, I guess being in the band for so many years, there have been so many Sunday morning worship services that you sit through, most of them, in Salvation Army halls. And so there's a certain pattern that perhaps the meeting might take. But what I found is some of our most interesting and special moments have been when we've been invited by another denomination to go and play and lead a Sunday morning worship with them. You really feel that at the end of the service, you've delivered the gospel in quite a new way. for some people. And that's really quite rewarding.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing that there. So you've been a soloist on many occasions also with the band. Have you got a favourite solo to perform?
Yes, I think I have. I spoke about it earlier on the album, the one called Up Yonder. I was lucky enough to have this written for me by a young Australian composer called Ross Irwin. He grew up at the Waverley Corps, playing in the YP band. I actually taught him to play cornet. It didn't take very long before he just up and went with it. And he turned into a fantastic jazz musician composer. So he wrote me this flugel solo, which actually used quite a few different jazz styles. And it was just such a fun piece to play because it gave me some scope to actually muck around a little bit. I don't take myself too seriously, to be honest. So there was some reasonable interludes between each variation, and I was able to sort of move around on the platform, go down into the audience, sit down and have a chat with an audience member, perhaps, things like that. On the very last occasion that I played it, which was in New Zealand, before I'd had a few months out of the band after that, bandmaster Ken kind of said to me, "Oh, don't go too far away, will you?" And I just took that as, all right, how far can I get? And one of the variations, I managed to sort of run out the back of the hall, up the staircase, and play one from the balcony. So that was kind of a fun thing, just a great piece that just allowed you to do those sorts of things. So it was a lot of fun.
Fantastic. That sounds very good indeed. Now, as you've alluded to a few times, you attend the Waverley Temple Corps, and I believe you're the bandmaster at that corps. How does your membership of the Melbourne Staff Band impact the way that you serve locally like that as bandmaster?
Well, I've been the bandmaster for nearly 25 years now at Waverley, and I've always thought that being a staff bandsman, you're there to set standards. Whether that be deportment or just how you act, or musical standards as well, and all aspects of playing, really. So I've always tried to uphold that as being a bandmaster. And I also, as I was encouraged as a young person, encourage all the young people as much as you can. Give them every opportunity. A few years ago, when we had a sizable YP band, I used to have young soloist nights, and whoever wanted to play a solo with the senior band got that opportunity to do so. Just encourage as much as you can. And, you know, that's what it's about.
Fantastic. That's brilliant to hear. And we could talk about Salvation Army banding all day, but I'm sure our listeners would like to hear even more about you specifically. Am I right in thinking that despite all the music making you do in your life, your career hasn't taken you down the music pathway?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. I actually studied to be an architectural draftsman, and I was in that profession for a number of years working in London. And once I moved out here, there was a building industry slump and no architectural jobs were really available. So I did one or two different things and ended up working in a rehabilitation physiotherapy department in a hospital, which was actually owned by the Salvation Army at the time. So I spent quite a few years there, which was really rewarding because it was helping people literally get back on their feet after car accidents and things like that, and help rebuilding their lives. But I knew that wasn't going to be what I was going to do forever. And while that was going on, my father-in-law had kind of started his own business selling x-ray equipment. And so he said, "Well, do you want to come and work for me?" So basically I sort of came into the family business. My wife Linda is in the business with us as well, with me now. Since then, that was well over 20 years ago. My father-in-law has retired. So it's Linda and I, we have our own family business selling x-ray equipment, which is all now digital. So it takes me, I won't say all over Australia, but a reasonable amount of it, around down the eastern side, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, and down to Tasmania. Perth is a long way away. That's like 4 hours flying from here. So I don't do a huge amount over there. But it gets me around, do a fair bit of driving. But it's great. It's great. Really enjoy it.
I've spent the whole time trying to think about some pun about bones, but I can't do it. So we'll just move on without a pun. But there we are. Failed on that this occasion. But on to a slightly more serious question perhaps now. In all the different places that you find yourself in life, how does your faith shape the way that you live?
Well, I think it's very much part of the way that you live, the person that you are. How you live sort of defines the person that you are and how you act around people. I'm not very good at one-on-one talking about spiritual things with people. That's not really my forte by any means. And in my work circumstances, the person I work with is my wife. So the friendships that some people are able to build at work and talk about Christianity, that's not there for me. When I go to my customers, I'm only visiting them for short periods of time, and often once my equipment is in there, I may not need to talk to them for quite a while. So there's not that great deal of connection that I can build with people in that respect. But just how you act can speak volumes, I think. The words that you use and the person that you are and the courtesy that you give people can just speak volumes without even having to speak about the Lord.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that about your life and opening up in that way. That takes us into the realm of quirky quickfire questions. So I've got some fairly normal quickfire questions and then some slightly less normal for you. We'll start with a few more of the normal ones, Shuri. Have you got a favourite Salvation Army composer?
That's a hard one. Everybody says it's a hard one because it is. I have a soft spot for Eric Ball because Dad was a great friend of Eric's. And when we were very young, if we were going down to Boscombe and Bournemouth for a holiday, we would often pop in and see Eric and Olive. I have very fond memories of him, and his music is magnificent. The Cornet Solo, Clear Skies, is one of my favourites. Dad used to play that so well. And Resurgam as well. Just magnificent pieces. All of his writing's wonderful. But you can't limit it to one person. My other favourite is Kevin Norbury. His writing is sensational. He was my singing company leader for a little while, and then became a great friend when we were in the senior band together.
Fantastic. And if you think that was a hard question, even more specifically, have you got a favourite Salvation Army band piece of music?
That is very difficult. Very difficult. It's a toss-up between Song of Courage or Resurgam.
Now on to some of the slightly stranger questions. Where is the strangest place you've ever been?
Well, Matthew, I'm not sure I've been to really very strange places, but probably the campsite of the Zambian Congress. Well, that's a very strange place to be. Chickens running around, half carcasses of animals hanging up, being cut up, like people playing drums, fires going, just an incredible place. It was fantastic and a bit weird.
Always a good mix. Now, if you could be a professional in any sport, what sport would it be in?
Cricket.
What's the nicest food you've ever eaten?
You can get some pretty good steak here. Pretty good steak with a nice bit of surf and turf with a shrimp topping. Can't beat it. Fantastic.
Wonderful. Who's the most famous person you've ever met?
Ooh. Well, whether you'd say I met her or not, I came very close to the Queen once when I was very little. But apart from that, I can't really think.
If you could choose one world record to beat, what world record would it be?
I don't know whether to go down the sporting line or the silly line. If there was one for holding the longest note without circular breathing.
Fair enough. That sounds good. If you want to give it a live try now, you're welcome. If you could go on a long hike with anybody from history, who would you hike with and where would you walk?
I'd love to know a bit more about William Booth and the visions that he had for the army in those young days. I think it'd be a great, great person to have a good chat with. And where would we walk? Probably around the Cotswolds somewhere. That would be nice. Somewhere where it's not too hot.
Sounds lovely. Where's the worst restaurant you've ever been to?
I'm trying to think if I ever came... Oh, yes. It was like a Taco Bell, I think. I came out with food poisoning within a couple of hours.
Oh dear, that does sound pretty bad. Yes. And we're not sponsored by them, so it's fine. And finally, what's the scariest animal that you've seen with your own eyes?
Well, I have been lucky enough. With my work, I have X-ray equipment in the Melbourne Zoo here. So I get to sort of go around the back areas of the zoo every so often. And one of those occasions that I visited, they had a lion, a big male, huge lion that was knocked out. They were giving his teeth a clean. And this lion, once you are up close to it, they are huge. Like, their heads are as wide as the desk. Like, just massive. And the paws are like three hands wide. Just... And what a majestic beast, even when he was asleep.
So that brings us to the end of the quirky quickfire question, to be relieved to know, and on to Band Manager 2024. So for any new listeners to the podcast, this section we have a fantasy band where all of our guests are asked to choose two nominations for the band. That can be for their outright playing ability, their impact on our guests' lives, both musically and spiritually, or for any other reason, really. So, Gary, who would your two nominees be for the Fully Scored Band Manager Band 2024?
Well, when I was looking at the list, and it's still fairly empty, which is good when you're one of the early people choosing the band, the principal cornet seat has not been filled yet, and I think that my dad, Ray Todd, would have been very worthy to sit there. So, that would be my first pick, Ray Todd as principal cornet. And then perhaps Michael Clack as perhaps the bandmaster. Because again, the bandmaster seat had not been chosen. So whether it's selfish of me to pick those two, I don't know. But really, those two people were very influential in my life. And I believe very worthy of those positions.
Absolutely. Two fantastic choices there. So thank you so much. Well, Gary, thank you for giving up your time for joining us today. We'll save a proper thanks for a little bit when we hear from you a little later on the podcast for Band Mastermind.
Oh, dear.
Thank you so much, Gary, for your time and sharing a snippet of your life story with us today. Now, returning for his second analysis, we have Dr. Ronald Holtz.
Well, Ron, thank you so much for joining us once again on Fully Scored. It's really, really great to speak with you. And today we're going to be looking at a tone poem from the pen of James Curnow, The Great Salvation War. So I've got a few questions, first of all, to get us to know this piece, and then we'll have a look at the score and take a look at the music involved. So my first question would be, where did you first come across this piece of music?
I heard the premiere of this work 1980 in Kansas City at the Centennial National Congress of the Salvation Army in America. Jim had written it for the Salvation Army Student Fellowship Brass Band of Asbury College. At that time in 1980, he was on the music department staff and he was the bandmaster of that fine band.
And can you tell us a little bit about the synopsis of the story that this piece of music is trying to tell and what its inspiration in being written came from?
He was intrigued by a book of his colleague, Dr. Edward McKinley, Salvation Army historian, called Marching to Glory, which was a history of the Salvation Army in America, which had come out in time for the centennial. And Jim said this about it, I'm quoting, "I endeavored to capture the spirit of early day Salvationists as they gave themselves completely to the Great Salvation War. The phrase itself appeared in the Pacific Coast edition of the War Cry on January 1, 1888, and was often used by pioneers to describe their daily struggle against Satan and his legions." So Jim chose three songs, I think very much along for Jim and Ed McKinley, their favorite songs to tell the story. "Stand Like the Brave," "In Thee, O Lord, Do I Put My Trust," the chorus, and then, particularly for Ed McKinley, the old "Rescue the Perishing." Now, those were the three songs. The piece is mostly connected around "Stand Like the Brave," which is an old Salvation Army song. You may recall it being used by Eric Ball very successfully in Song of Courage. In terms of the trajectory of the piece, it's very much spiritual warfare music. So the first almost two-thirds of the piece are about battle, okay, using "Stand Like the Brave." And then there's the reflective middle when our hero or heroine feels in the middle of the battle, I need help, Lord, in Thee, O Lord, where I put my trust, which is just, the chorus states that over and over again as it goes higher and higher. And then, of course, the ending, the last part, which is in many ways not very long, of "Rescue the Perishing" in augmentation, surrounded by motives derived from the "Stand Like the Brave" ideas. So that's really what the tone poem is trying to do. It's about standing up to face the foe. All the music is always rushing upwards. In fact, even "In Thee, O Lord, Do I Put My Trust," it's the same phrase over and over again, up sequentially. So it's a very positive, uplifting score from that perspective. And that's what Jim was trying to portray.
And to help us put this work into its context, whereabouts in the output of James Curnow's writing does this piece fall?
It comes just as Jim is being recognized as one of the finest wind band writers in America, and of course he's been writing a number of works for the Salvation Army as well. He's already a full endorsed professional at that time, right at the top of American wind band music.
Fantastic. Well, I think that would be a good point to delve into the score and look at it in some more detail, and we'll hear the excerpts played as we go through. So I don't think there's a better place than the beginning to start. Could you tell us a little bit about this introduction and how it sets up the work?
Right from the get-go, we're in battle, okay? And there's a canonic response between the tenor trombones and the solo and first cornets, a rising line, okay? But moving slowly against that are the mellows and the tubas with an exciting percussion underneath it. And then in bar five, you have the same idea in diminution, okay? Going very, very fast. And those ideas will be stated over and over again, along with gradually the interjection of the main motive, "Stand Like the Brave," which will be used very, very effectively by Jim throughout this opening section. And I would say that one of the interesting things about this tone poem is its proportions. In other words, this Great Salvation War, the majority of it, is about energetic warfare. So in other words, if you had to graph this, in the 7.5 minutes it takes to do this piece, a large percentage of it is the energetic opening warfare, okay? And then you have the reflective section in "Thee, O Lord, Do I Put My Trust," which is itself a rising idea up. And then, of course, almost the tag at the end, "Rescue the Perishing." By the way, I don't know if Jim was influenced, but the idea when he brings rescue the perishing at the end, it always reminded me of what Les Condon did in Present Age when suddenly we get Courage, Brother, you know, in the last part. At first, we're kind of stunned, like, where did that Victorian hymn tune come from? Same thing here, Rescue the Perishing. But the use of it becomes very, very effective in the last little bit of the piece. There are some dangerous things in this piece. The main thing is the key scheme. This starts out in band pitch C, B flat concert, but it ends in D flat. Okay, and so we're rising up. Okay, it's what we would call open tonality. In other words, we purposely are deciding to go up. Now that's a very warm key for brass bands, D flat, but it is rife with intonational problems. So I would say those who are preparing it, careful from the big cadence in the middle of, and thee, O Lord, do I put my trust, which goes to D flat. And then the ending section, which is in D flat major, watch out. Because, you know, and even an A flat for the E flats, those are tough keys to play in tune. Okay. It can be very effective, but boy, is that challenging.
And when this piece was written, in the era of Salvation Army music, there's a real emergence, and had been for probably about 20 years previously, of the American school of writing in Salvation Army music.
Right.
What do you think is it about this piece that gives it its distinctive American soundscape?
Well, I think it reminds me so much of what Curnow has absorbed in the American wind band tradition, okay? Whether it's people like Persichetti or others, and there's that sense of, first of all, modern harmonies built in seconds and fourths, parallel and fanning harmonies, in other words, kind of like the spider doing the push-ups on the mirror kind of writing. And it's a very new sound. Very little use of traditional, for lack of a better term, sentimental harmonies behind the songs, you see. Even when these songs are being used, you're not hearing them in their original context. You're hearing them in new expressive ways, whether it's the way he builds the climax to "In Thee, O Lord, Do I Put My Trust," or even the appearance of Stand Like the Brave, which, by the way, it takes a long time for him to develop until we actually hear the whole song. We hear fragments and we hear his original music based on that, but it takes a while before that to come through. But the sound is very American, okay, in that sense, which can go all the way back to Copland, really. Okay, Copland and Barber and others from the late 30s and 40s. So I think Curnow has absorbed that sound into his own writing style. And even Rescue the Perishing, you can't get more Victorian than that Rescue the Perishing song. But Jim frames it with reiterations of Stand Like the Brave and is able to place it. Almost sounds like an augmentation, but actually it should not be rushed. I would say, I think the score says quarter note equals 132 plus, okay, for that last section. My caution is don't go much faster than 132, because I think you'll lose the majesty of Rescue the Perishing as it sounds against all that other busy material. So I would be careful not to push the ending tempo too much on that. That's just my observation. But yeah, it's definitely a new sound world. And the idea of those motor rhythms and the percussion underneath it, that's an American sound, okay, that came into Army music. Well, it really started with what Bruce Broughton was writing in the late 60s, early 70s, and some of his works too, okay? You know, Bruce's treatment of the old Lowell Mason tune, when he wrote Covenant, Okay, I mean, people think that's a modern work. That was written way back in 1970. You know what I mean? So 10 years before this one. Okay, so both of those guys were very much absorbing the American symphonic sound and the American, for Jim, the American symphonic wind band sound, okay, in what he wrote.
And how much of that American wind band tradition do you think that we hear and see in this piece specifically?
Well, quite a bit, as a matter of fact. And I would say that until you get to the middle section, okay, it's rife with Americanisms, is what I would say. Until you get to Thee, O Lord, okay, and the counterline, ba-da-da-da-da, that modal idea, that's more traditionally can be said to be part of our own Salvation Army tradition, that I would say it's the American sound dominates it, okay? Dominates it. And it was interesting when that piece was premiered on that same program were pieces like Steve Bulla's suite of overtures about the four territories. There was also the Chicago Staff Band playing Eric Lightson's old songs in the heart. I mean, there were some, the old and the new. And I think why this piece captured so much of everybody's imagination was this, for most of the people knew, it was a new sound, okay? For many of us growing up in that wind band tradition, it wasn't, okay? So, but basically, I would say that it was dominantly American in its approach.
So going back to the score, it isn't until letter H that we first see it referenced into the score, the first iteration of the tune Stand Like the Brave. What can you tell us about that melody?
Well, we almost always hear it in just the chorus. Because remember when Eric Ball uses it in Song of Courage, he just uses stand like the brave, stand like the brave, stand like the brave with your face with the front. He just does that. But how many of us know the other words? God's trumpet is sounding to arms, is to call more warriors are wanted to help on the war. My king is in the battle. He's calling for me, a salvation soldier, for Jesus I'll be. That's the verse. But we don't sing that anymore. We might sing Stand Like the Brave, maybe. Okay, a couple of old saints get their glory some Sunday night. They might pull that out, you see. And the same thing is true of Rescue the Perishing. I mean, that was Ed McKinley's favorite Victorian song. But again, you listen to the words, oh my goodness, a little treacly. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying, snatch them in pity from sin and the grave. Weep o'er the erring one, lift up the fallen, tell them of Jesus, the mighty to save. Now that's the verse that's being expressed. The average person would say, what on earth is that? But they might know the chorus, rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Jesus is merciful, Jesus will save. They might know that, you see. So there is a little bit of education going on for both the audience and even the band members these days, if you're going to go back to this piece.
Now to shine a little spotlight on the next, perhaps transitional moment of the piece. We've gone from this battle and warlike ostinato-driven music that's very intense. How does Jim transition us into the very much opposite and juxtaposed in the O Lord throughout section M into N?
Well, what he does, he uses a new idea, which is itself derived from the opening motive. So in letter L, the soprano cornet. Begin to get K counter lines. Da da di da da. Okay, very much a Kernow trait. And before the flugel even begins its solo at letter N, those ideas are springing out of the opening battle music. But what a change, that molto rao, three before M, okay, that idea. And we can see where those ideas are coming from, but by the time the solo cornet gets a hold of it at letter M, it's something new altogether and becomes a counterline for the for that next section. And of course, he ain't going to give up on Stand Like the Brave either, is he? He's going to bring that back in during the presentation. I wanted to mention something at letter P that for those of you who are concerned, here's where D flat first comes in solidly, okay? And watch out for the tuning. But notice the tempo mark. Poco piumoso and with fervor, okay? But then T-E-N building to a typical climax. If Jim were conducting, he'd stretch that to the max. I mean, almost to wish the soprano player wish he didn't, okay? And he would really, really stretch that tenuto marking going into the alt-tempo. But the key there is don't make a meal of it. Make sure you do a little piumoso with fervor before you start pulling it back, okay? And then the row. Because I think Jim can build layers and layers and layers. And if you've ever played under Jim, you can never quite get rich enough. He always wants a little bit more from you. Okay, so I would just caution that. But watch out for those flats.
And before we talk about that final section, the climax, how does the use of In the O Lord and the selection of that tune fit in with the overall narrative of the music at this stage?
Well, I would say that after all the battle music, it's a reflective position on the part of our hero or heroine in the middle of the battle, realizing it's not about me, it's about the Lord strengthening me through his spirit. Therefore, I must trust him in the midst of this, what I'm called to do. And I'm going to put my trust in the Lord. And again, the idea of fully standing up to one's potential via the indwelling of the Spirit in one's life. And I think that's very, very important to bear in mind, because it's not long-winded, the use of the song. It's after a little of the meditative stuff, when the song finally comes in, you only really hear it once completely, okay? Building, of course, to a majestic reaffirmation of faith, we would, and then we're ready. We're ready to make sure that we are indeed going after the perishing. Okay.
And as listeners or those studying this score of this music throughout section R, where we have that iteration of rescue the perishing, what are some of the things that we should be looking out for, taking note of in the music itself?
Well, it's a balance issue, isn't it? Because while you have the marching rhythm underneath, you have the motive from the first part accompanying Rescue the Perishing. Here's a balance issue. Okay, if you're not careful, the solo cornets and the trombones, okay, on the second time through are going to bury that tune, okay, carefully. But notice that Jim purposely lets the song sound by itself the first time, okay? And only at the forte level. Typical Kernow, he's gonna build and build, but the fortissimo doesn't come till S, okay? But be careful that the balance over all that is carefully placed so that the Stand Like the Brave stuff doesn't get in the way too much, although it is the excitement, is it not, for that whole section.
And to conclude the piece, I guess like any good Beethoven symphony, lots of these motifs are brought back in for the coda. Is there anything, again, that we should be looking out for as musicians in the concluding section of this music?
Well, there are any number of things, but he kind of wraps it all up at the end. Stand Like the Brave, Rescue the Perishing and Augmentation, and even the Counterline. Everything is put back at the end. You know, I have a feeling that Jim purposefully condensed this last section. Maybe he was pressured to get it written so the band could learn in time for the Congress. But on the other hand, I'm glad that he didn't make a protracted ending, okay? That we reached the idea of our calling, that we are to rescue the perishing, and we are to stand like the brave in the midst of it. And I think he states it very, very well. At the end, all the ideas layering on top of each other. Molto rale at the end, isn't it? Stand like the brave, rescue the perishing, and the little typical Kernow, ba-da-da-da-da, and a little modal ending, typical Jim. It just condenses the whole argument, you see, I think, at the end, and making sure that you don't overdo it, too, okay? That's all. Notice he, by the way, T's at the end. Fortissimo, but in bar two, only forte. Okay? Only forte. So that you can build to the end, and so that the counterline in the altos, first baritone, euphonium can be heard, keep that forte piano down, okay, until the final note. And you pray that the boys play in tune.
Fantastic. Well, Ron, thank you so much for your time, but also your expertise and that light that you've been able to shed on this magnificent piece. And thank you for joining us once again on Fully Scored. I hope that we're able to hear from you again in the future.
Very pleased to do it. Enjoyed it very, very much. Thank you.
Thanks again, Ron. It's now time to batten down the hatches, tighten the rigging, and unfurl our sail as we depart for this month's instalment of Arid Island Album.
Land ahoy!
Welcome to Arid Island. Today's guest is Jerome Astwood. Well, Jerome, thank you so much for joining us on Arid Island Album. It's really, really great to speak to you. And we're on the metaphorical Arid Island here. But can you tell us a little bit about where you're actually coming from today?
Today I'm coming from Bermuda, a little speck in the Atlantic, just off the coast of the Carolinas, and glad to be here.
Amazing. So can you tell us a little bit about your connection with Salvation Army music?
Sure. Well, I kind of came up in the youth band program at my home school. But at the time when I first started, we didn't have a band per se. They just played on Sunday mornings, so I went down to the Hamilton Citadel, which is in the middle of the island, and learned music there from, I think it was YP Bandmaster, Vince LaHayward. And from there, it was just, a labor of love. I fell in love with it, and it just created a safe space for me. And my parents, my mom actually, she's a pianist. Well, she was a cool pianist. Actually, she still plays from time to time. And she encouraged my brother and I, and took us there for rehearsals. And then eventually, Akua, as we got older, developed into having more music programs and stuff. And we started to take over in some of the leadership there as we got older as well. So it's really been a wonderful journey of musicianship as well as Salvationism.
Amazing. And are you still actively involved in the music scene as well?
Yeah. I mean, I guess just like everywhere else, we took a little hit from the pandemic. So, we had to, shelter in place and all of that. But things are starting to pick back up. We've been quite busy. Because the island's just 20 square miles, you could walk the distance in a day of the island. We were only like a half an hour to an hour drive away from the next school. So we have a lot of different like regional services and stuff to support. So here lately, I found myself quite busy with our regional band, carrying out kind of like a band secretary role and helping to keep that going and flourishing.
Fantastic. That's really, really good to hear from your perspective there of Salvation Army music in Bermuda. So your career, can you tell us a little bit about your career? Because that's not down the music route, I understand.
Yeah. Well, it's funny enough, I did want to study music when I finished high school. And at the time, I got into Berklee College of Music in Boston. And but it was just a little too expensive. So my parents said, well, why don't you work for a little bit, save some money, and then we can probably support you to go after that. And so my dad saw an ad in the paper for the Police Cadet program. And right out of high school, fresh 17-year-old, I joined the Bermuda Police Service as a cadet for a year. And I went to Bermuda College while I was a cadet, because that was part of the program. And it was, I just fell in love with it, I guess. And it's been a varied career. I worked in just about the uniform as well as plainclothes departments. This is my 32nd year this year. And I got promoted to sergeant probably about 18 years ago. And it's been a roller coaster ride, I would say. But crime's not too bad on the island. But just like we have a Bermuda folk song called "Bermuda Is Another World," it's still part of the world as well. So, it's been good to help to make the island safe and work on international investigations and been over to the UK and the States, Canada, down in the West Indies, Central America and stuff, working on investigations and intelligence work. Most of my work's been in intelligence work, but now, the last couple of years, they put me out to pasture, I believe. I'm working in the courts. So I supervise and a team that administrates and provides security for the courts of Bermuda. So yeah, that's my day-to-day job.
Fantastic. Thank you for giving us that little snapshot and something. Well, really interesting. I'm sure we could speak about that all day. But we must come on to the all-important question. If you were stuck on another arid and deserted island and could take one album with you, what would that album be and why?
Oh, man. Well, we have so many albums and it's so hard to choose. But I think if it was anything, it would probably be the first volume of the Essays for Brass by Yorkshire Building Society. With Dr. David Keane. I think that if it was anything that encapsulated Salvation Army music in a way that I would need and I would enjoy and would take me through that part of the journey would be there.
Fantastic. Well, Jerome, that is an excellent album pick, and thank you so much for giving up your time to join us today and to speak with us and share a little snapshot into your life and, of course, your Arid Island album, Album Choice.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time, Jerome, and for your excellent album choice. Hope to speak again with you soon. As yet, the sparsely scored crown of victory is yet to be claimed. So we'll add another band part into the mix to see if any eagle-eared listeners' memories are jogged. Last time, you heard the second cornet and bass trombone. This time, we're adding on the second baritone. If you can identify the band piece from those sparse parts, then drop us a direct message on any of our social media platforms to be crowned champion. Once again, I can sense a strain of fear as we head over to the band mastermind hot seat, where Gary Todd joins us to see if he can top the fully scored board. Gary, welcome back to the Band Mastermind Hot Seat. How nervous are you on a scale of 1 to Z?
Yes, very much Z. Yes.
Very much. Okay, so for new listeners, Band Mastermind, you'll have 1 minute and 30 seconds to answer as many band trivia questions correctly as you can, and we'll see you placed somewhere on the Band Mastermind fully scored board. Have you got any goals or anyone you're striving to beat?
Well, at least if I get on the board, that'll be great. At least have one.
Oh, you'll be on the board. No problem, I'm sure. Righty, okay. Gary Todd, are you ready to play Band Mastermind?
Let's do it.
Your time starts now. What was Kenneth Downey's first published march?
Pass.
How many principal cornets have been in the ISB under the tenure of Stephen Cobb?
Three.
Incorrect, I'm afraid. To the nearest 10 seconds, how long is the recording of Isaiah 40 on the Manuscripts album?
10 minutes 47.
Incorrect, I'm afraid. Who succeeded John Mott as bandmaster of the Household Troops band?
Carl Saunders.
Correct. Who performed William Hines' cornet solo Jubilance at the 2015 Boundless Congress?
Peggy Thomas.
Incorrect, I'm afraid. Who is the current bandmaster of the German staff band?
Pass.
Can you name one person who's led a staff band and a staff songsters?
Len Ballantyne?
Incorrect, I'm afraid. In what year was the Christmas Collection published?
2018.
Correct. Can you name one of the four members of the music editorial team in the UK?
Andrew Blythe.
Correct. Of what corps was Ray Bowes the bandmaster of?
I know it. Because I went and played solos with Dad there. Pass. I'm annoyed.
And that takes us to the end of the time, I'm afraid. That gives you a grand score of 3, which is really not a bad score at all for Band Mastermind. I'll go back through the answer of the questions that you didn't quite get. So, Ken Downey's first published march was the Joybringer.
Okay.
There have been 5 principal cornets in the ISB under the tenure of Stephen Cobb. Bonus points for anyone at home that can name all 5. To the nearest 10 seconds, the Isaiah 40 recording on Manuscripts is 12 minutes and 35 seconds. And who performed Jubilance at the 2015 Boundless Congress? It was Philip Cobb. The current bandmaster of the German staff band is Howard Evans. Now, we reckon there are three people who have both been a leader of a staff band and staff songsters: Harold Bergmaier, Peter Ayling, and Dick Crummenhook. The other members of the music editorial team you could have had are Simon Gash, Alan Williams, and David Wright. And this is the one you may want to kick yourself under the table for: Ray Bowes was the bandmaster at the Harlesden Corps.
Oh, of course it was. Ah, annoyed about that. Yeah.
There we go. Under the pressure of band mastermind, things slip the mind easily.
Yes. That's away.
Well, Gary, thank you so, so much for giving up your time to join us on the podcast and for sharing a little insight into your life and your music making. Really do appreciate, and it's been a real privilege to speak to you.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been a real honour to be on the show. Thank you very much.
Commiserations, Gary. It's not the top spot on the leaderboard this time. But as always, not a bad score for band mastermind. And with that, it's time to wrap things up for this episode. As ever, if you've enjoyed spending your time with us, please do consider leaving us a rating or review, especially on Apple Podcasts, as this helps new listeners to find us. Now for a few thanks. Thank you to our exceptional trio of guests, Gary, Ron, and Jerome, for your willingness to give up your time and be part of this podcast. Much appreciated. Thank you to our producer, Simon Gash, for scooping and applying the technological grouting onto the segmented bricks of this episode to make a strong and sturdy wall of podcastery. Thank you to Wobplay for hosting this episode and playlist to accompany. Thanks also to the powerful yet predictable tidal swell of the ocean, the other band nerds, for the band mastermind trivia. Psst. Psst. Hey, you. Yeah, I'm talking to you. Thank you for tuning in. See you next time. Goodbye and God bless.